ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Today on Future Tense on ABC Radio National, a tale of two cities, two futuristic cities, and of the ambitions of the very powerful leaders behind them, China's Xi Jinping and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Anthony Fennell. Both cities, Neom in Saudi Arabia and Shung'an, just south of Beijing, are pet political projects, designed to impress, to make a statement about the future potential of both nations. Let's start first with Shung'an and Andrew Stokels, an assistant professor of urban studies at Singapore Management University.
So I've been following Shung'an as a scholar of Chinese urbanism, development, and initially was interested in the city just because it seemed to be quite different from some of the previous Chinese new areas in that it was being championed directly by the leadership and specifically Xi Jinping to serve as a model of something new, something distinct from the urbanization models of the preceding 20 or so years under the reform and opening period, because Shung'an represents, in my view, a reassertion of the central state's role in development and planning in China.
And how does that play out in terms of the architecture, in terms of the design of the city, indeed even of the population?
Yeah, so when we think about Chinese cities, particularly some national new areas that were also supported by national leadership, Shenzhen, of course, is one of the most successful, was Deng Xiaoping's project. And Shanghai built a new business center called Pudong across the river from the old part of Shanghai in the 1990s under Jiang Zemin. So these cities were really trying to attract foreign capital, build impressive skylines, really import and in some way mimic the urbanism or the city building styles of the West. So with Shung'an, there's actually a conscious effort to not do that. So there are specific design guidelines that Shung'an is not supposed to have glass skyscrapers. It's not supposed to have glass curtain walls. It's not supposed to have gated communities, which is actually something that Chinese cities have become known for. But the thinking was that gated communities are enclaves of privilege, of inequality. Shung'an was also supposed to have traditional Chinese design thinking and wisdom embodied in it. So there's been a conscious effort in the design process to weave natural rivers through the area, parks with Chinese style architecture. So really the whole style and emphasis is on building something modern, but at the same time, distinct and Chinese.
And that ideological approach to Shung'an's planning and development follows a Chinese Communist Party ideal known as ecological civilization.
So ecological civilization has been around for some time, predates Shung'an, and it's kind of a vague term like most Chinese policy slogans are. But in general, ecological civilization refers to the idea that China is trying to build sort of new form of civilization following industrial civilization, which is associated with the West. And ecological civilization is intended to reconcile development, technology, and ecological protection. And Shung'an definitely represents that and makes many references in the planning documents to ecological civilization. So it is connected, although ecological civilization is a broader discourse and it's been around for a lot longer than Shung'an.
This is to be, as you've said, a green city. I understand around 70% of it is to be reserved for green areas. But it's also meant to be a smart city, isn't it? Tell us about that aspect.
Yeah, so a lot of cities around the world have tried to brand themselves as smart, and there's some confusion about what that actually means. In Shung'an, it's actually very specific. So there is a really extensive effort to embed digital infrastructure into the city from the ground up. So there's a slogan that's used when they talk about this called three cities. So Shung'an is composed of the city underground, the city on the ground, so the buildings, the physical city, and the city in the cloud. And this is a nice kind of term because it captures the infrastructure that's being built underground, which includes really deep, large underground utility mains or utility corridors that hold utility lines, but also potentially can deliver logistics, deliver packages underground automatically, and also digital infrastructure. So really, it's a state-managed effort to create a digital infrastructure system and a unified sort of data-driven urban management system that will unify all forms of digital government data, systems data, data on population, transportation. The thinking is that this is a smart city. And of course, there's been many examples of smart cities not really living up to their promise. But there's a pretty significant investment in hard infrastructure and digital infrastructure in Xiong'an.
Given that there is so much surveillance in China already, are there concerns about the kind of surveillance that might take place within this city?
Well, I think the density of cameras, the density of IoT sensors, it's a very conscious effort to really make this city completely visible to authorities. And that could be used for solving practical problems like deploying emergency vehicles in the event of a fire or another situation. Or it could be used for surveillance, as you suggested. And so I think it's impossible to separate the two. Some of the uses are more benign. Some of the uses may be more authoritarian in nature. And so when you look at smart cities in China, even the existing smart city projects like the City Brain project in Hangzhou, which is one of the more successful examples, it was used to control traffic with CCTV cameras and AI algorithms to monitor the streetlights. A lot of these programs are sold on improving urban efficiency, improving government services, making it easier for people to access public services. So really, there's a level of convenience, and that's how it's marketed. But of course, in China, it's inseparable from these other more control-oriented or political surveillance programs. So they're really part of a package, I would say.
And this is a city that's not designed for everybody, is it? Who's expected to live in Xiong'an when it's completed?
The main person or the sort of intended worker or future resident of Xiong'an is really, I would say, a government worker or a worker for a state-owned enterprise. And so the idea is that housing and other services in the city are not meant for just anyone, but it's meant to be very controlled so that you can only obtain these services if you receive a job and you're really meant to be in Xiong'an. But then once you're inside that system, you ideally receive a lot of subsidized services and other advantages provided by the state. In that sense, it's interesting because it represents somewhat of a return to the more controlled state-run economy of the 1950s and 60s, which sometimes termed the Danwei system, where most workers in cities lived and worked and played and ate within compounds that were attached to their workplace. So Xiong'an is not exactly going back to that, but it's in some way it represents an effort to bring the state back into people's everyday lives in a way that had been missing in a lot of the market-driven development in the last few decades in China.
And so in that sense, is it correct to say that this is in many ways a test for Xi Jinping, that he's looking to see whether this kind of ideological arrangement will work at a broader scale over time?
Yeah, I think Xiong'an is a sort of testbed, a showcase of what Xi would like to see for future Chinese cities. And the question of how much that will actually be adopted elsewhere remains to be seen, because so far, Xiong'an has not really attracted the level of interest, the level of residents or workers that, you know, Shenzhen attracted. But it should also be mentioned that Shenzhen, in its first 10 years of history, developed very slowly, was doubted by many within the party. So there is still time, and given the importance of Xiong'an to Xi Jinping, depending on, you know, the political dynamics at the top, if Xi Jinping is in power for a lot longer, then Xiong'an may continue to receive investment, more companies will be relocated there, and eventually it could take on the form of a more dynamic, populated city. But until then, it's really unclear to what degree Xiong'an represents a model or really an exception. But there are reports that there's a lot of doubts and criticism of the project, even within leadership in China. So this is really being driven by Xi. And in that sense, I think the city's fate is really tied to the political career of Xi himself. And many people see it that way in the city itself.
Andrew Stokel's there from Singapore Management University. Now, futuristic metropolis number 2 is similar to Xiong'an in its ambition and the fact that it's become synonymous with the country's autocratic ruler. In this case, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But whereas Xiong'an is intended to have a certain understated quality, there's no nuance when it comes to neon.
For too long, humanity has existed within dysfunctional and polluted cities that ignore nature. Now, A revolution in civilization is taking place. Imagine a traditional city and consolidating its footprint.
The idea was really tied up with an overall economic overhaul, you know, started around when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman came to power around 2016. And they wouldn't put it this way, but I think the idea was essentially to do a Dubai on steroids and make this international city that was hyper-modern and was seen as a magnet for wealth and business globally.
Elliot Brown, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, based in London.
And so they sort of looked in northern Saudi Arabia and saw this large chunk of land that had a lot of really beautiful natural features and put the thumb on the map and said, let's do it here and start from scratch.
So a grand vision. Was this also a way of moving the economy away from dependency on oil?
Yeah, that's kind of the central pillar of their what they call Vision 2030, because Saudi Arabia for decades has really been a petrostate and highly dependent on oil. And they're aware as any that that one day will come to an end. And some of their neighbors have been quite successful at developing local economies using that money that they have from oil to plunge it into subsidizing new economies and giving them a start. And Saudi, unlike some of their neighbors, has really a large number of people. I mean, there's 35 million or so people that live there and a young population. So I think they realized we need to transform this economy and move just beyond the oil we're pumping out of the ground.
It was pitched as not just a city of the future, but as a civilizational leap. What were the key promises in terms of the economy, in terms of livability, in terms of technology, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be the future everything, sci-fi and promise and delivery. So the ambition was really large. It was to have 9 million people live there. The key feature is the line, which is this 160-kilometer long building that runs 500 meters tall. The idea is essentially to have a 9 million person city in a single pair of buildings that run parallel through the desert. So there'd be no cars, you'd get around on people movers and electric helicopters. Everything would be hyper-digital. You'd have a digital passport and, you know, all the industries there would be digital industries of the future and hyper-new industrial design. But a lot of it was sort of planned back by consultants in the late 2010s with just sort of new technology will fix this. So, you know, things like elevators that go diagonal, which haven't really been, I mean, they've been invented, but haven't really been implemented. It's like, yeah, we'll just have them everywhere, that type of thing.
As you mentioned, Saudi Arabia's population, perhaps a surprise to many people, is quite a young population. Do we have any idea what the population, what the average people in Saudi Arabia thought of the Crown Prince's grand vision?
I mean, it's a little hard to tell because it is an autocracy and with a controlled media environment. But generally, academics and other groups report it did succeed in igniting the imagination of Saudis and sort of got them excited about it. But, you know, in terms of people that actually were ready to pick up their bags and move there, you know, the day it opened, hard to really say how many people would actually do that.
Now, you recently reported on cost overruns, delayed timelines and internal governance concerns. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we found was there was an internal audit done last year that painted or, you know, found a fair amount of financial manipulation done by staff of NEOM in the way they presented costs to the board and therefore the Crown Prince. And a broad way of looking at what was going on is what we called a dance of mutual delusion, where the Crown Prince sort of initially came up with these completely wild ideas and said, yeah, let's have a, you know, vertical city of 9 million where costs are low and everyone's happy and has hyper futuristic architecture. That message would go down below him. And then internally at NEOM, they would essentially create ways to justify how that could work financially. But the problem is, it's incredibly expensive to do what the Crown Prince wanted. So, you know, the audit found and people we've spoken to have discussed how executives and consultants would effectively manipulate financial figures to make these things, you know, seem like they were financially possible when the true cost would be extraordinary.
And what's the situation at now? How much of the Crown Prince's dream has actually been achieved?
Today, not much. You know, an easier answer is nothing yet. That's not to say there's nothing that's been going on. There's been an enormous amount of construction, tens of billions of dollars over the past few years. You can sort of look on Google Earth and see there's a 100-kilometer gash in the desert where they dug the trench for what would be the train line that runs along the line. They've dug the foundations of the initial few modules of the line, the 3 or so kilometer first buildings. And there's been a island resort that officially opened in October of last year, but continues not to actually be open to the public. And there's a fair amount of construction going on right now at a Arid Mountain ski resort that they're building, which was another one of these flashy, you know, architectural daring endeavors. So, you know, right now it's still an enormous amount of construction and not much to show, you know, in terms of when stuff starts opening. That's more of an open question.
Has there been a recalibration? Have parts of the project been pruned or postponed?
One of the challenges here is that the Saudi state doesn't offer much detail and sort of will say things like, this was always the plan. So, for instance, the line, if you look at their own rhetoric, it was supposed to be open by 2030 and have 1 million residents in its first chunk, which, you know, equates to about 16 kilometers. That's now been pruned back to 2.4 kilometers is at least the stated intent. And so that's what they've been digging. Otherwise, they haven't really talked about much that's actually been pulled back. What we understand from reporting is they've sort of mothballed this giant train line that they dug the trench for, as well as a huge new international airport. You know, in terms of exactly what else they're pulling back on, it's hard to really say. The project's been under various forms of review for at least a year now.
And according to your reporting, the final estimate for the cost of this whole project, if indeed it does go ahead, is going to be in the trillions, isn't it? I mean, Saudi Arabia has vast resources, but where are they expecting to find the money for it?
You know, back in 2017 or so when it was launched, you know, the initial intent was to take $500 billion of their oil wealth and plunge it into this and sort of build a city. A document we saw, Neom, a sort of draft board presentation, put the total price tag for everything at around $8.8 trillion. You know, that's a pretty big gap. And so, yeah, like you said, Saudi Arabia, I don't think people quite realize that they do have a lot of money, but they need a lot of money to spend on things. And, you know, if you have 35 million people, and that requires a big budget. So, you know, their sovereign wealth fund in total has around $1 trillion in it. And the wealth fund is tasked with a huge array of other priorities, such as, you know, revitalizing or, you know, revamping the entire Saudi economy. So there's a very large gap between the ambition and the reality here.
Has there been any indication of what the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, what he thinks of NEOM so far?
In terms of his thoughts on exactly what's been going on and how it's living up to his vision and the implementation, no, I don't have great sense into that. But the driving issue here is that this is really Mohammed bin Salman's plan. He's the one that wanted the architecture that's proved extremely expensive. And then, you know, the state and NEOM has essentially gone along with that, but in a way that people internally find completely unrealistic. He's the one at the top. He's the one involved in a lot of the architectural decisions, and he chairs every board at NEOM. So, yes, I would love to sort of get a sense of what he's thinking about it right now.
It is an autocracy, as you mentioned. It's hard to get a really good gauge on what's going on. But are the overruns approaching a state at which crunch time has to hit fairly soon?
What they've said publicly, the folks at NEOM, is that they hope to start vertical construction on the line by the end of this year. And if they're going to hit their latest target dates, which I think are 2034 or so, to complete a building with a stadium for the World Cup, they really would have to get going. But when you're building a building, that's crunch time. That's when you really start to figure out the costs. It's sort of like if you're renovating a house, your architect can say, oh, this is sort of what we think it'll cost, but you really don't know until you get contractors to give you a bid. So I think we're approaching that point. And then when those bids come in, the Saudi state basically has to make a decision as to whether they're going to foot this really extraordinary bill for the first chunk of the line or not, or delay it. You know, you can always delay projects. You don't have to cancel them. That's where we're at. I mean, the first phase of the line in that same document I mentioned earlier, the price tag was $370 billion. And so that includes a number of other things beyond the first chunk of the line. But that is a really big bill, even for Saudi. I mean, I believe that's bigger than their annual federal budget. It's a big decision to make. And I guess we'll know at some point when they've made it.
Well, Elliot Brown from The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're with Future Tense, an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. From urban structures to the structure of the brain. And Nicholas Wright is a neuroscientist who researches the brain, technology and security at University College London and Georgetown University in the United States. He has a new book out called Warhead, in which he argues that to deal effectively with conflict and to prevent future wars, we first need to get a better understanding of the way the human brain functions. Nicholas Wright.
So throughout history and prehistory, every generation has faced life-threatening emergencies. So that could be starvation, it could be war. That's why every human brain is built to win or at least survive a fight. And when you travel through the human brain, and that's what I do in the book, all the way from the brainstem right at the base, all the way through to the very other end of the brain, you see there is no one simple reason why humans are driven to fight, but there are many causes. So take fear, for example. It sounds counterintuitive, but fear is useful. We need fear. Down nearer the bottom of the brain, there are key regions of the brain called the amygdala that are vital for fear. And if you don't have those brain regions, you can lose the ability to see fear in others and feel fear yourself. And when that happens, you don't become some kind of fearless warrior who can take whatever you want whenever you want it. You actually become a victim often. You become a victim of things like crime. We need social motivations like the rejection of unfairness or injustice to motivate us, to drive us forwards. And yet, on the other hand, when groups both have too exclusive a view of social injustice, they can end up fighting each other. There will always be misunderstandings, misperceptions. And there will be a minority of humans always who will be Hitler's or Bin Laden's or Vladimir Putin's who will drive us towards war. But I think we can be optimistic that if we know why humans fight and why humans are driven towards conflict, that we can reduce the chances of that. If we can understand ourselves better, we can reduce the chances of war. And if we must fight, then we can win. And that's why I think I'm optimistic. If we can see us as we really are, then we can get to a more peaceful world. We can get to peace through self-knowledge.
So why have we not given as much attention, perhaps, as we should have to neuroscience when we're talking about our propensity for warfare?
So I think it's in large part because there have just been huge advances in neuroscience over the last 20 odd years, and it just takes time for that to work its way through. So to give you an example, I work in a research institute in London called Queen Square, and it's a really exciting place to work, and there are hugely exciting ideas about the brain that come out of there. It was closely linked with both of last year's Nobel Prizes in AI, for example. Both are linked directly to thinking about how the brain works, but it just takes time to feed that through. So to give you a practical example, the very first flag officer, that's a general or an admiral or whatever, the very first flag officer I ever briefed in person in the Pentagon was just over 10 years ago. And I've been working with the Pentagon Joint Staff for over 10 years now as an advisor. And I advised the then Brigadier General about the brain. I spent an hour, just him, me, and a couple of his team talking about the brain. He was asking me how we can influence others, how we can think about deterrence, how we can control escalation. He then went on to be very successful, and he's now in charge of NATO. He's now the four-star general, the most senior general in charge of United States Europe Command, in charge of NATO. And he is an interested, reflective guy, and he has the ideas that I gave him, you know, over 10 years ago now, sitting in there along lots of other ideas that he has. It just takes time.
So neuroscience is important for understanding the enemy and the way the enemy might think or react. It's also important, from what you've written, in understanding the way we will react, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. If we don't understand ourselves, so for example, in the run-up to World War II, right there, we needed to understand Adolf Hitler, but we also needed to understand ourselves. What were we really going to do? Were we really going to fight? And of course, in the run-up to World War I, the problem within the run-up to World War I is that none of the great powers really in Europe, none of them really wanted to go to war. And yet, because they didn't understand themselves well enough, they ended up clashing. They weren't restrained enough, and that caused problems. They didn't see enough of the big picture. But what we can do now is, as we understand ourselves better, we can, for example, think about our own thinking. We can enhance that in ourselves, right? This is what the frontal pole does at the very far end of the brain. We can think better about our own thinking. We can enhance that in ourselves, and that can help us make wiser decisions.
In talking about warfare and the workings of the brain, we're not just talking about individuals, are we? We're talking about a collective state of mind, the way the brains of an entire nation might actually think about a situation or a possible threat. Is that correct?
Definitely. And what's remarkable about humans is that we can create these groups of more than a couple of hundred individuals at all. No other primates, right, can form groups of more than a couple of hundred individuals. Chimpanzees form groups maybe 40 or 50 on the whole. Baboons might get to a couple of hundred. How on earth do humans form these gigantic groups? How do we get to the scale of tribes that's, you know, say 2,000 or 3,000 individuals, or to the hundreds of thousands or millions who live in states? So humans have this ability to form these gigantic groups, and that central understanding how we do that, how our brains enable us to do that, this what I call social alchemy, this ability to turn disparate individuals into a coherent enough group to act together, that requires answers to the question, who am I? So that's our identity. And also, how are things done around here? That's our culture. And then there will always be leaders. It is a natural propensity for humans to have leaders and followers, right, in our groups. And those leaders need to be more effective, need things like the ability to self-reflect so that they can have adequate self-confidence to make decisions. They need to have a clear model of how things are going to work so they can give that to others and coordinate them moving forwards. And they also need the ability to communicate. They need the ability to communicate that model. And you see that brilliantly now, for example, in Vladimir Zelensky. He has those capabilities. If he can carry on, and that's one of the reasons why he was a lot more effective in the early part of the war in Ukraine since 2022 than Vladimir Putin. But will he be able to continue it on throughout the war, as Winston Churchill did, for example, but as Adolf Hitler didn't? And that again requires reflection, thinking about himself and using those around him and using himself, his own brain, better.
You mentioned the advice that you've given to military leaders. Are all major militaries now thinking about thinking, as you say?
Yes, it is central to, for example, how the Germans were the best military on land, soldier for soldier, in World War II, for example. They were better than the British, they were better than the French, they were better than the Americans. They were very, very good. And part of that was about creating more reflective officers, officers who were better at learning and reflecting, doing things like war games and so on, all of these techniques. And so after World War II, for example, the British and the Americans and the Australians, we all copied some of those techniques. And if you look now at China, for example, they know, I spend a lot of time working, thinking about China and the Chinese military with people from America and Britain and Australia and so on. And, you know, the Chinese really value the human side, the human element, the will to fight, the ability to think more clearly and more effectively and faster. Yes, they value technology, but they know that the human brain is always going to be the central weapon of war.
Nicholas Wright, author of the book Warhead, and he's a neuroscientist at University College London and Georgetown University in the United States. You've been listening to Future Tense on ABC Radio National. Karin Zsivanovits is the program's producer. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.